theme of the Stalinist military genius. The advanced Soviet science of war received further development, he writes, at Comrade Stalin's hands. Comrade Stalin elaborated the theory of the permanently operating factors that decide the issue of wars, of active defense and the laws of counteroffensive and offensive, of the cooperation of all services and arms in modern warfare, of the role of big tank masses and air forces in modern war, and of the artillery as the most formidable of the armed services. At the various stages of the war, Stalin's genius found the correct solutions that took account of all the circumstances of the situation. And further, writes Stalin, Stalin's military mastership was displayed both in defense and offense. Comrade Stalin's genius enabled him to divine the enemy's plans and defeat them. The battles in which Comrade Stalin directed the Soviet armies are brilliant examples of operational military skill. Equals. It can be argued, though, that precisely because his claim to leadership was shakily based, it had to be exaggerated and made unchallengeable. Lenin, whose dominance in the party was genuine and accepted, had no need of such methods. For Stalin they were, in part at least, the necessary cement of autocracy. One shrewd Soviet diplomat in the 1930s writes, "Anyone who imagines that Stalin believes this praise, or laps it up in a mood of egotistical willingness to be deceived, is sadly mistaken. Stalin is not deluded by it. He regards it as useful to his power. He also enjoys humiliating these intellectuals." To discuss Stalin's character and beliefs is not to estimate his abilities. There have been two main views of these. On the first, he was an infallible genius, a coryphaeus of science, an inspired leader of the human race, and so forth. On the second, he was a mediocrity. The first view, taken, during Stalin's lifetime, by Professor Bernal, Khrushchev, and others, has been submitted to enough destructive criticism, and we need hardly deal with it. The view that he was a nonentity who reached the top by luck and low cunning still has influence. It is true that most of those who hold it would concede that he was also a monster. But they would grant him few other active qualities. The Menshevik historian Sukhanov, soon to be his victim, described him in 1917 as making no more impression than a gray blur. Trotsky called him the most outstanding mediocrity in our party. And Khrushchev later said, in his secret speech of 1956, "I shall probably not be sinning against the truth when I say that 99% of the persons present here heard and knew very little about Stalin before 1924. He had, in fact, made little impression on the talkative politicians of the party at that time. Thus there was some basis for the judgment of Trotsky and his successors. But on the whole it was a shallow one, as later events bore out. The qualities Stalin lacked and Trotsky possessed were not the essentials for political greatness. And Lenin alone among the Bolshevik leaders had recognized Stalin's ability. It is early yet to look at his career objectively, with his technique of despotism simply considered as a fine art. Nevertheless, we can avoid dismissing with a negative estimate of his unsuccessful rivals and their intellectual heirs the brilliant politician who was able to produce such vast and horrible effects. Stalin had a good average grasp of Marxism, and though his adaptations of that flexible doctrine to suit his purposes were not so elaborate or so elastic as the similar interpretations of his rivals and predecessors, they were adequate to his career. His lack of the true theoretician's mind was noted by many, and he seems to have resented it." Bukharin told Kamenev in July 1928 that Stalin was eaten up with the vain desire to become a well-known theoretician. He feels that it is the only thing he lacks. The old Marxist scholar Ryazanov once interrupted Stalin when he was theorizing, "Stop it, Koba, don't make a fool of yourself. Everybody knows that theory is not exactly your field." Nevertheless, as Isaac Deutsch rightly comments, his great theoretical departure, socialism in one country, however crude and even un-Marxist a notion, was a powerful and appealing idea. Deutsch says that the interest of practitioners of Stalin's type in matters of philosophy and theory was strictly limited. The semi-intelligentsia from whom socialism recruited some of its middle cadres enjoyed Marxism as a mental labor-saving device. But this view exaggerated Stalin's philosophical clumsiness. Or rather, perhaps, it overrates the more philosophical Bolsheviks, such as Lenin, with whom Deutsch goes on to compare him. Lenin's only venture into philosophy proper, Materialism and Imperio-Criticism, is his least impressive work. Stalin's brief summary of Marxism, which appears in Chapter 4 of the Short Course History of the All-Union Communist Party, is, in an unpretentious way, as clear and able an account as there is. Georg Lukács, the veteran communist theoretician, who in the 1950s showed some revulsion from Stalinism, commented, "Since we have to do with a popular work written for the masses, no one could find fault with Stalin for reducing the quite subtle and complex arguments of the classics on this theme to a few definitions enumerated in schematic textbook form. With the exception of Zinoviev, Stalin was the only non-intellectual in Lenin's leadership. But his knowledge of more truly relevant matters was not small. Gilos tells us that Stalin had considerable knowledge of political history only, especially Russian, and he had an uncommonly good memory. Stalin really did not need any more than this for his role. In 1863, Bismarck reminded the Prussian chamber that politics is not an exact science. It would have been a truism to every previous generation, and he was perhaps provoked into giving the idea such definite expression by the rise of the new rationalism in historical science, of the claims to rigor of the social and political professors. Among the Russian communists of the post-revolutionary period, this tendency had reached its fullest development. They were political scientists, they were using the methods of the political science devised by Marx, the Darwin of society. Everything was discussed in theoretical terms. Unfortunately, the theories were not correct, and the claim to scientific rigor was, to say the least, premature. Even if their formulations had been closer to the definitiveness claimed for them, it is still perhaps doubtful if such leaders would have prevailed in actual politics. Professors of ballistics do not necessarily make good baseball players. As it was, the more intuitive Stalin, less able to analyze and plan his moves in theoretical terms, had a fuller operational grasp of reality. As his daughter remarks, in spirit Stalin was completely Russianized. He had not learned Russian until he was 8 or 9, and always spoke it with an accent. But he spoke it well, and his conversation was often rich and vivid in a coarse way. Although not well educated, he was widely read in the Russian classics, in particular, the satirists Shchedrin and Gogol. He had also read when young a number of foreign authors in Russian translation, in particular, Victor Hugo, and popular works on Darwinism and social and economic matters. Gendarmerie reports on the Tiflis Theological Seminary in the last part of the 19th century mention the reading by students of seditious literature of this sort, and Stalin's name appears in the seminary bad conduct book a number of times for the discovery of such works from the local cheap library, showing that he was engaged in absorbing this sort of self-education. His style of writing was unsubtle, and here again his opponents sneered at him. Gilos associates it, and its crudeness, with the backward nature of revolutionary Russia. It contains simplicities from the writings of the Church Fathers, not so much the result of his religious youth, as the result of the fact that this was the way of expression under primitive conditions. Gilos adds elsewhere that his style was colorless and monotonous, but its oversimplified logic and dogmatism were convincing to the conformists and to common people. But there is more to it than that. Clear and plain arguments are appealing not only to common minds. A Soviet official writes, "It was precisely his lack of brilliance, his plainness, which inclined us to believe what he said." Stalin is often described as having a curious effect of sullenness, but he could be charming enough, and had a rough humor, self-assured but not entirely without subtlety and depth. In this he contrasts with the humorlessness of Lenin, and of Trotsky too. It seems doubtful that he would have had the same sort of success in a more experienced political community, but in the political circumstances in which Stalin found himself he proved a master. Tactically, he far outshone his rivals. Buckhorn commented of him that he was a master of dosing, of giving the right dose at the right time. It is a measure of Buckhorn's own comparative ineptitude that he seems to have thought of this as an insult. In fact, it is a sound compliment to one of Stalin's greatest strengths. He won his position by devious maneuver. It is notable that from 1924 to 1934, there were none of the abrupt coups which marked the post-Stalin period. Stalin would attack and discredit a man, then appear to reach a compromise, leaving his opponent weakened but not destroyed. Bit by bit his opponent's positions were undermined, and they were removed one by one from the leadership. Lenin saw this side of Stalin's political methods. When he was working to defeat Stalin on the Georgian issue in the last days of his active life, he told his secretary not to show Kamenev the notes he had prepared for Trotsky, or they would leak to Stalin, in which case Stalin would make a rotten compromise in order then to deceive. And this indeed Stalin did in the months following Lenin's death, exhibiting, as Gibbon says of Alaric, an artful moderation, which contributed to the success of his designs. It was because Stalin never committed himself irretrievably until he felt certain of success that his opponents were so often put into a dilemma. They were never sure how far he was intending to go. And they could, and did frequently delude themselves into thinking that he had submitted to the will of the Politburo majority, and would henceforth be possible to work with. Even when he was pressing forward hard to the terrorist solution of the question of the oppositionists, they were able to feel that this was partly due to the influence of Kaganovich and others, whom Stalin might well be induced to abandon if suitable arguments were produced. It is notable that few of the alternative solutions seriously put forward from 1930 onward envisaged the total removal of Stalin from positions of power, which alone could have saved the situation. Thus, in a manner almost unprecedented in history, he continued his coup d'état by inches, culminating in a vast slaughter, while still giving an air of moderation. Through his silences and unprovocative talk, he not merely deceived many foreigners, but even in Russia itself, at the height of the purge, was to some degree able to avoid popular blame. A friend who had contact in the higher circles in both Stalin's Russia and Rakosi's Hungary remarks that Rakosi was indeed much the more educated and in a sense more intelligent man. But he laid himself open in the most unnecessary way. The most important example was that during the period of the Reich trial in 1949, he made a speech saying that he had spent sleepless nights until he himself had unraveled all the threads of the conspiracy. When Reich was rehabilitated, this was a deadly weapon against Rakosi. But quite apart from that, it meant that even at the time he personally was blamed by the people and the party for all malpractices in connection with his purge. Stalin, who never said a word more than was necessary, would not have dreamed of making so crude a revelation. It was his triumph that the Great Purge was very largely blamed on Yezhov, the head of the NKVD. Not only I but very many others thought the evil came from the small man they called the Stalinist Commissar. The people christened those years the Yezhovshchina, Yezhov Times, remarks Ilya Ehrenberg. Ehrenberg also tells of meeting Pasternak in the Lavnashensky Lane on a snowy night. Pasternak raised his hands to the dark sky and exclaimed, "If only someone would tell Stalin about it." Meyerhold, too, remarked, "They conceal it from Stalin." In fact, the opposite was true. The cartoonist Boris Efimov describes his brother Mikhail Koltsov telling him of a conversation with Meklis, who explained how the arrests were taking place. Meklis showed him, in confidence, a few words in red pencil addressed to Yezhov and Meklis, laconically ordering the arrest of certain officials. There were, Koltsov noted, people still at liberty and at work, who had in fact already been condemned and annihilated by one stroke of this red pencil. Yezhov was left with merely the technical details, working up the cases and producing the orders for arrest. Stalin's achievement is in general so extraordinary that we can hardly dismiss him as simply a colorless, mediocre type with a certain talent for terror and intrigue. He was, indeed, in some ways a very reserved man. It is said that even in his younger days, if beaten in an argument, he would show no emotion, but just smile sarcastically. His former secretary penetratingly remarks, "He possessed in a high degree the gift for silence, and in this respect he was unique in a country where everybody talks far too much." His ambitions, and even his talents, were not clear to most of his rivals and colleagues. Because he did not elucidate and elaborate his views and plans, it was thought that he did not have any, a typical mistake of the garrulous intellectual. His expression, an observer writes, tells nothing of what he feels. A Soviet writer speaks of the expression which he had carefully devised for himself over the years as a fixture and which Comrade Stalin, as he had long been in the habit of calling himself in his thoughts and sometimes aloud, in the third person, had to assume in the presence of these people. He would listen quietly at meetings of the Politburo, or to distinguished visitors, puffing at his Dunhill pipe and doodling aimlessly. His secretaries Poskrovichev and Divinsky write that his pads were sometimes covered with the phrase "Lenin teacher friend," but the last foreigner to visit him, in February 1953, noted that he was doodling wolves. All early accounts agree that one of Stalin's characteristics was laziness or indolence, which Bukharin impressed on Trotsky as Stalin's most striking quality. Trotsky remarked that Stalin never did any serious work but was always busy with his intrigues. Another way of putting this is that Stalin paid the necessary attention to the detail of political maneuver. In his words, "never refused to do the little things, for from the little things are built the big." One may also be reminded of a remark by a former German commander-in-chief, Colonel General Baron Kurt von Hammerstein Ackward, about his officers. "I divide my officers into four classes. The man who is clever and industrious is suited to high staff appointments. Use can be made of the man who is stupid and lazy. The man who is clever and lazy is fitted for the highest command. He has the nerve to deal with all situations, but the man who is stupid and industrious is a danger and must be dismissed immediately." In the political struggle, Stalin's great characteristic was precisely nerve. He had complete determination and considerable patience, together with an extraordinary ability to apply and to relax pressure at the right moment, which carried him through a series of critical situations, until his final victory. At the center of Stalin's superiority over his competitors was certainly his intense will, just as Napoleon ranked what he called moral fortitude higher in a general than genius or experience. When Milo von Gilas said to Stalin during the Yugoslav-Soviet discussions in Moscow during the war that the Serbian politician Gavrilovin was a shrewd man, Stalin commented, as though to himself, "Yes, there are politicians who think shrewdness is the main thing in politics." His was a willpower taken to a logical extreme. There is something non-human about his almost total lack of normal restraints upon it. He is said to have been a constant reader of Machiavelli, as indeed is reasonable enough. In chapter 15 of The Prince, he would find the simple advice that rulers should in no case practice villainies which might lose them the state, but must nevertheless, if it comes to the worst, not flinch from being blamed for vices which are necessary for safeguarding the state, making whatever effort is feasible to escape the evil reputation involved. Or, again, in chapter 18, Machiavelli recommends the appearance of mercy, faithfulness, and so forth, while noting that the prince and especially a new prince, must often act in a fashion contrary to those virtues. When the great film director Eisenstein produced his film on Ivan the Terrible, Stalin objected to his attitude. He had been inclined to treat Ivan, in the way most people have, as a ruthless and paranoid terrorist. Stalin told Eisenstein and the actor N.K. Cherkasov that, on the contrary, Ivan had been a great and wise ruler who had protected the country from the infiltration of foreign influence and had tried to bring about the unification of Russia. J. V. Stalin also remarked on the progressive role played by the Oprichnina, Ivan's secret police. Stalin's criticism of Ivan was limited to his having failed to liquidate the five remaining great feudal families. On that point, Stalin added humorously, "Their God stood in Ivan's way, since Ivan, after liquidating one family, would repent for a year when he should have been acting with increasing decisiveness." Stalin also understood how to destroy his enemies' political reputations. He could have learned in certain respects from another totalitarian leader whom he to some extent admired. Hitler gives a recipe for the whole tenor of the purges. The art of leadership, as displayed by really great popular leaders in all ages, consists in consolidating the attention of the people against a single adversary. The leader of genius must have the ability to make different opponents appear as if they belonged to the one category, for weak and wavering natures among a leader's following may easily begin to be dubious about the justice of their own cause if they have to face different enemies. Where there are various enemies, it will be necessary to block them all together as forming one solid front, so that the mass of followers in a popular movement may see only one common enemy against whom they have to fight. Such uniformity intensifies their belief in their own cause and strengthens their feeling of hostility towards the opponent. But Stalin was deeper and more complex than Hitler. His view of humanity was cynical, and if he, too, turned to anti-Semitism, it was as a matter of policy rather than dogma. We can see traces of this later anti-Semitism, or rather anti-Semitic demagogy, as early as 1907, when he was remarking, in the small underground paper he then controlled at Baku, somebody among the Bolsheviks remarked jokingly that since the Mensheviks were the faction of the Jews and the Bolsheviks that of the native Russians, it would be a good thing to have a pogrom in the party. The Yiddish writers shot in August 1952 were accused of the political offense of wishing to set up a secessionist state in the Crimea, a charge faintly linked with reality through the fact that a proposal had indeed arisen in the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, after the war, to resettle Jews in the then desolate peninsula. In the Doctor's Plot of 1952 to 1953, a majority of those accused were Jews, but some were not. The Jewish element was publicly emphasized, but it was under the guise of a link with Zionism, just as in the campaign leading up to it, Jewish literary men were called cosmopolitans, that long-nosed lot, a bureaucrat. Comments in one of Avram Terets's stories. When critics in the West pointed out the undoubted anti-Semitic element in the alleged plot, there were still people to come forward and say that, no, Gentiles were being accused too, and that Zionism was, after all, more or less implicitly anti-Soviet. For, as we shall see, Stalin's policies in strictly political matters were never elaborated clearly in such a fashion that they could be refuted. There was never any complete certainty in an individual case about what his disposition would be. This enigmatic attitude misled even experienced and clever people. Lion Feuchtwanger, Ehrenberg remarks, a passionate defender of the Jews, could never believe that Stalin persecuted Jews, just as Roman Roland, devoted to freedom in the arts, was easily deceived by Stalin on the absence of freedom in Soviet literature. The anti-Semitism, thus disguised, was in accord with Stalin's general exploitation of prejudices and of the gullibility and pliability of men in general. In a broader sense, this was doubtless at the root of Stalin's acceptance of the theories of the physiologist Pavlov, who loathed the Soviet regime. Moreover, he interpreted Pavlov in the crudest way as applying to human beings, sponsoring an attack on the view that Pavlov had dealt with the elementary nervous process of animals only, and that in the case of man it was necessary to take into account the phenomenon of resistance to the formation of conditioned reflexes. But the dull, cool, calculating effect given cumulatively through Stalin's long career, the air of a great glacier moving slowly and by the easiest path to overwhelm some alpine valley, is only part of the picture. At various times, and especially in his early career, the calm of his general manner was broken, and expression given to the driving emotions that possessed him. In Lenin's time, if offended, Stalin would sulk and stay away from meetings for days. Tilda Lenin noted of him that he often acted out of anger or spite, and that spite in general plays the very worst role in politics. He also noted Stalin's hastiness and his tendency to solve everything by administrative impulse. At the time of Lenin's death, he had nearly ruined himself by this capriciousness and needed all his skill to retrieve the situation. Nor, later, was his terrorism wholly rational. He practiced brutal violence, not only toward everything that opposed him but also toward that which seemed, to his capricious and despotic character, contrary to his. 9951. Concepts. As George Kennan has remarked, to Stalin's darkly mistrustful mind no political issue was ever without its personal implications. His daughter takes it as central to his character that once he had cast someone he had known a long time out of his heart, once he had mentally relegated that someone to the ranks of his enemies, it was impossible even to talk to him about that person anymore. There can be no doubt that Stalin pursued his grudges implacably, even after many years. But, of course, this cannot be more than a partial motive for the killings he ordered. For these involved friends as well as enemies, and men he hardly knew as much as personal rivals. Men who had injured him did not survive the terror. And nor, of course, did men whom he himself had injured, like Bauman. Nevertheless, when Khrushchev represents Stalin as a capricious tyrant, this is not necessarily incompatible with a basic rationale. It is true that anyone Stalin had a personal grudge against was almost automatically included on the death list, but even a long life of quarrelsome intrigue could not provide anything like the required number of victims from that source alone. To obtain the terror effect, after all those who really had stood in his way or annoyed him had been dealt with, the quota could just as efficiently be made up by caprice as by any other method. Stalin's terror, in fact, begins to show a more rational pattern if it is considered as a statistical matter, a mass phenomenon, rather than in terms of individuals. The absence of strict categories of victims, such as a Trotsky might have listed, maintained the circumspect deviousness of the purge and avoided presenting any clear-cut target to critics. The effect of terror is produced, he may have argued, when a given proportion of a group has been seized and shot. The remainder will be cowed into uncomplaining obedience. And it does not much matter, from this point of view, which of them have been selected as victims, particularly if all or almost all are innocent. Ilya Ehrenberg, as late as 1964, still asked himself why some were shot and some spared. Why Litvinov was never in serious trouble, though kept away from active work for years, while all the diplomats associated with him were eliminated, why Pasternak, independent and unyielding, survived, while Koltsov, anxious to do everything required of him, was liquidated, why the biologist Vavilov perished, and the even more independent-minded Kapitsa remained in favor. Whatever the statistical rationale, the way Stalin's caprice operated is a useful sidelight on his character. A British writer of great political experience noted in the 1940s, it seemed almost as if Stalin simultaneously demanded and hated the sycophancy of absolute obedience. This was confirmed and elaborated in a more recent Soviet account by the novelist Konstantin Simonov, who had much direct contact with the high Soviet leadership. In his Soldiers Are Made, Not Born, Stalin receives a letter from a general during the war asking for the release of a colleague, whose Civil War services he recounts. Serpilin's recalling of past efforts had failed to touch Stalin. It was the directness of the letter that had interested him. In his ruthless character side by side with a despotic demand for total subservience, which was the rule with him, there lay the need to come across exceptions, which was the adverse side of the same rule. At times he evinced something akin to flashes of interest in people who were capable of taking risks, of expressing opinions which ran counter to his own opinions, whether genuine or assumed. Knowing himself, he knew the degree of this risk and was all the more capable of setting store by it. Sometimes, that is. Because it was far more frequently the other way around, and this was where the risk lay. Stalin gives Serpilin an interview, which goes fairly well. Still, on his way out, Serpilin considered that his fate had already been finally settled during his conversation with Stalin. But in actual fact it had been settled not while they had been talking but a moment ago when Stalin had silently looked at his back as he left. That was the way he often finally decided people's fate, looking at them not in the eyes but from behind as they left. With certain categories, Stalin seems to have had different standards. His former Georgian rivals and friends were mostly shot, like their Russian counterparts. But whereas Stalin showed nothing but contempt for most of his victims, the execution of his Georgian old Bolshevik brother-in-law Alyosha Svanidze in 1942, on charges of being a Nazi agent, brought out a different attitude. Before the execution, Svanidze was told that Stalin had said that if he asked for forgiveness he would be pardoned. When Stalin's words were repeated to Svanidze, he asked, "What am I supposed to ask forgiveness for? I have committed no crime." He was shot. After Svanidze's death, Stalin said, "See how proud he is, he died without asking forgiveness." An even more extraordinary example is that of another Georgian, S. Ikov Taraje. He had been chairman of the Council of People's Commissars in Georgia from 1921 to 1922, and had fallen with the rest of the Georgian leadership during Stalin's clash with them before and after Lenin's death. He was expelled from the party as a Trotskyite in 1927, and was among those not readmitted during the following years. He was arrested and sentenced in connection with the Ryutin affair, and is reported in Marinsk and Kolyma labor camps in 1936, thoroughly disillusioned. In 1940, he was still in camp. One day the commandant called him, and he was sent off to Moscow. Much to his surprise, instead of being shot, he was taken directly in his prison close to see Stalin, who greeted him affably, asking him where he had been all these years. He was at once rehabilitated, and sent to the Commissariat of Foreign Affairs, where he shortly became Assistant People's Commissar. After the war, he was ambassador to Romania for a time. In his biography, as given in various Soviet reference books, a bare mention is made of the 13-year gap in his party membership between December 1927 and December 1940. This is a clear and conscious example of Stalin indulging a caprice of his leading opponents in post-revolutionary Georgia. While he had indeed been shot, he made a remarkable exception to the purge spearing Philip Mukherjee. Mukherjee, though publicly censured for various errors in the particularly sensitive field of Georgian party history, registered remained chairman of the Presidium of the Georgian Supreme Soviet until he died, in good odor, in 1943. His survival is very peculiar, unless, indeed, we regard the reprieve as amounting to no more than 4 years' imminent expectation of arrest, and see in it a particularly subtle piece of revenge. What may be a curious remnant of Caucasian chivalry can be seen in one of Stalin's more general omissions from the purge lists. He had no objection to killing or imprisoning women, in fact, wife is mentioned as a normal category for execution, see here. But within the inner party itself, there is a curious survival of old Bolshevik women. Krupskaya, Lenin's widow, is in a sense a special case, though she had been strong in the opposition to Stalin in the 1920s and had given him personal offense. But it would not by any means be beyond Stalin's powers or beyond the usual scope of his malice to prove that Lenin's wife had betrayed her husband. But there are many other cases of old Bolshevik women surviving. Elena Stasova lasted right through the Stalin epoch. L. A. Fotiva, Lenin's secretary, who must also have known a good deal about what was one of Stalin's most sensitive points, the quarrel with Lenin in his last days, was also spared. So was K.I. Nikolaeva, the only woman full member of the 1934 Central Committee apart from Krupskaya, who was one of the few who was carried over into the committee elected in 1939, and she was an ex-Zinovievite at that. Another case was R.S. Zemelyaka, member of the 1904 Central Committee. A brutal terrorist, she had been Bela Kun's chief colleague in the Great Slaughter in the Crimea in 1920, to which Lenin himself had objected. She survived, while Kun went to the execution cellars. Alexandra Kollontai, the star of the workers' opposition, had been married to Dybenko and had lived with Shliapnikov. On top of all this, after her acceptance of the Stalin line she remained as ambassador to Sweden, a profession which was anyhow almost invariably fatal. Yet she survived the Stalin epoch unscathed, end post. Psychologists might make something about this trait of Stalin's. In any case, it is a comparatively human characteristic and one perhaps harking back to Caucasia as much as the blood feud does. Another category to be spared has no such obvious source, the former Bolshevik members of the Duma, including Grigory Petrovsky, who was under the direct threat in 1939, all survived. But when all is said, we are still peering into the glooms of an extreme reticence. A shrewd Soviet official, who was impressed by Stalin's patience and also by his capriciousness, comments, "That rare combination is the principal key to his character." Doubtless this is a sound view, yet it only takes us into the outskirts of a full understanding. Even as to his political aims, He never spoke his mind. That he knew in general what he was doing cannot be doubted. It is much more difficult, as we have seen, to tell how far he had made his aims explicit even in his own mind, and how far ahead he looked during a given crisis. What he had, politically speaking, was less definite than a planned control of developments. It was, rather, the feel of events, the flow. In this he was unsurpassed among his contemporaries. We do not need to posit a conscious long-term plan to say that in a general way the drive for power was Stalin's strongest and most obvious motivation. There have been men, like Cromwell, whose paths to supreme power were truly accidental, who neither planned nor particularly wished for the result. This is quite certainly not true of Stalin. Bukharin said plainly, at any given moment he will change his theories in order to get rid of someone. But politically speaking, this shows a basic consistency. The one fundamental drive that can be found throughout is the strengthening of his own position. To this, for practical purposes, all else was subordinate. It led him to absolute power. As Machiavelli points out, though the actual seizure of power is difficult in despotic states, once seized, it is comparatively easy to hold. And Stalin seized it and held it. Over the next 4 years, he carried out a revolution which completely transformed the party and the whole of society. Far more than the Bolshevik Revolution itself, this period marks the major gulf between modern Russia and the past. It was also the deepest trauma of all those which had shaken the population in the turbulent decades since 1905. It is true that only against the peculiar background of the Soviet past, and the extraordinary traditions of the All-Union Communist Party, could so radical a turn be put through. The totalitarian machinery, already in existence, was the fulcrum without which the world could not be moved. But the revolution of the purges still remains, however we judge it, above all Stalin's personal achievement. If his character is to some degree impenetrable to direct investigation, we shall see it adequately displayed in his actions over the following years, and in the state he thus created and found good. Old Bolsheviks confess. In what did his fascism show itself? His fascism showed itself when he said that in a situation like the present we must resort to the use of every possible means. Exchange between Vyshinsky and Zinoviev at the August 1936 trial. The 6 months following the Medved-Zaporozhye's trial is one of the most obscure periods of the purge. It starts with the death, in circumstances which are still unknown, of another member of the Politburo, and ends with another trial, of which even the charges were only made public in 1989, of Kamenev and others. But the pattern is clear, and much of the detail can now be reconstructed. After the first wave of terror following the Kirov murder, the moderate faction in the Politburo continued to urge the policy of relaxation. It could, after all, equally well be argued that the assassination was the sign of tensions which might best be dealt with by a more popular policy, as the opposite, that it indicated the need for further terror. In the Politburo, Valerian Kuibyshev, head of the State Planning Commission, Gosplan, is believed to have been particularly active along Kirov's line, and is said to have opposed the January Zinoviev, Kamenev trial. Plus outside, the influence of Maxim Gorky and of Lenin's widow, Nadezhda Krupskaya, was of importance. The Society of Old Bolsheviks, which had long acted as a sort of party conscience, strongly opposed the idea of death sentences for the opposition. Among Stalin's immediate entourage, Abel Yanukidze, who was secretary of the Central Executive Committee and, among other duties, responsible for the administration of the Kremlin, urged the same view. Yanukidze was the first target of Stalin's countermeasures. As if to emphasize the connection, he was required on January 16, 1935, the very day Zinoviev and his adherents were sentenced, to perform a significant though minor act of self-denunciation on the always thorny theme of the origins of Georgian Bolshevism. In a half-page of Pravda, he wrote of his errors in articles in the encyclopedias and elsewhere, where he had attributed too big a role to himself. This marked the beginning of his rapid decline. The next great blow to moderation was the death of Kuibyshev on 26 January. Most of his subordinates in Gosplan, including his deputy, Professor Rosadchi, had been purged for opposing ill-prepared crash programs in the first years of the decade. Although Kuibyshev's death was at first described as being from natural causes, it was later to be alleged that he was murdered by willful medical mistreatment on the orders of Yagoda. It is still difficult to be certain about the Kuibyshev case. Common sense gets us nowhere. There are, in fact, two different commonsensical ways of looking at it. The first would say that what appears to be a natural death should be taken as such if there is no absolutely firm evidence to the contrary. After all, Kuibyshev had to be ill in the first place if he was being treated medically, people do die naturally, and we should not strain to fit every death into a preconceived pattern. The other view is that Kuibyshev had, as is now officially said, been one of three Politburo members who had blocked Stalin, that of this group one had been shot just before Kuibyshev's death and the other was to perish later of a faked heart attack, and that, moreover, Stalin was making moves against other advocates of moderation, such as Gorky and Yanukitsa, at precisely this time. Against a member of the Politburo, at once more dangerous and less vulnerable, what sanction was left except the one that had succeeded with Kirov? At any rate, a certain amount of suspicion seems reasonable when we consider that all the other 9 Politburo members, and 10 ex-Politburo members, to die in the years 1934-1940 were victims of Stalin, that all those of his own supporters who opposed him on the purge perished, and, perhaps most important, that the others of his own Politburo supporters who died before 1938 were disposed of by him, but in ways not easily attributable to his own actions. Kuibyshev was photographed at a meeting of the Council of People's Commissars on 22nd of January. On 26th of January, his death was announced, of heart disease. The signatories to the medical bulletin included Kaminsky, Kodorovsky, and Levin, all of whom were to sign the certificate of or John Ikidze's equally sudden death from the same cause, which is known to be a fake. Kuibyshev seems to have had a bad heart, and to have been under treatment at least since August 1934. An attack of tonsillitis and an operation weakened him still further. But he was not at this stage particularly ill, and was still at work within an hour or two of his death. The account of his death given at the Bukharin trial was that he had some sort of angina pectoris attack while at his office at the Council of People's Commissars, was allowed to go home unaccompanied, and climbed to his flat on the third floor. There chanced to be a maid at home who telephoned his secretary and the doctor on duty, but by the time they arrived Kuibyshev was dead. It was alleged that it was the purposely incorrect treatment which had been given him which caused his death, and that the doctors should anyhow have insisted on his being in bed. The doctors, and Kuibyshev's secretary Maximov, were later accused of working under Yagoda's orders. They were rehabilitated in 1988, and are thus clearly innocent. If Kuibyshev did not die naturally, he was killed in some other way than that stated, perhaps by another member of the Council of People's Commissars dropping in from a nearby office with a glass of non-medicine. If so, it is possible that the true facts were known only to a few now dead, and that they are no longer available even to investigators in Russia. However, the most recent Soviet references stress his heart condition. Among those actively opposed to the persecution of oppositionists throughout this period, another of the most forceful was Maxim Gorky. Moreover, his great ambition was to assist in a reconciliation between the party and the intelligentsia, to lead the Soviet regime, of which he had originally disapproved, into the socialist humanism he believed it capable of. It was partly for this reason that he had compromised himself by returning from Italy in 1928 and defending the regime against its external critics. Gorky is said to have personally worked to reconcile Stalin with Kamenev and to have apparently succeeded in doing this early in 1934, even securing a friendly personal meeting. Kamenev was given a job in the Academia Publishing House. Gorky is said to have at first been greatly enraged against the supposedly anti-party assassins of Kirov, but soon to have reverted, as far as general policy went, to his liberal position. Stalin's resentment at his stand was expressed by the appearance, for the first time, of articles highly critical of him. For example, one by the writer Pan Farov in Pravda of January 28, 1935. However, Gorky continued in his efforts to reconcile Stalin with the oppositionists. So did Krupskaya, who had been Kamenev's and Zinoviev's main ally in 1924. Krupskaya, up to a point, represented a moral threat to Stalin's plans. But unlike Gorky, she was a party member and subject to that same party discipline which had led her to acquiesce in the suppression of her husband's testament. Her sympathies with the Zinovievite opposition over the years had been common knowledge in the party. By now she had as a result lost most of the prestige she had once enjoyed on the higher levels, even though her name was still useful with the party masses. The exact methods by which Stalin silenced her are unknown. He is said to have once remarked that if she did not stop criticizing him, the party would proclaim that not she, but the old Bolshevik Elena Stasova, was Lenin's widow. Yes, he added sternly, the party can do anything. This story, from Orlov, has, not unnaturally, often been doubted, but it was confirmed by Khrushchev in his memoirs, where he says that Stalin used to tell his inner circle that there was some doubt whether Nadezhda Konstantinovna was really Lenin's widow, and that if the situation continued much longer we would begin to express our doubts in public. He said that if necessary we would proclaim another woman Lenin's widow. He named the replacement, of whom Khrushchev says only that she was a solid and respected party member who was still alive as he dictated the memoirs. Stasova, or possibly Lenin's secretary Fotiva, seems the only plausible candidate. In any case, there was little Krupskaya could do. It was not difficult to keep foreigners away from her, to surround her with NKVD men, and at the same time to call on her to obey the party's orders, a situation quite different from that of Gorky. It is said that she was in fear for her life in her last few years. On February 1, 1935, a plenum of the Central Committee elected Mikoyan and Chubar to the posts on the Politburo left vacant by the deaths of Kirov and Kubashev, and promoted Zhdanov and Nik to candidate membership. To the extent that Mikoyan, at least, was to support the extreme Stalinist line throughout the purge period, as, of course, was Zhdanov among the candidate members, this was a gain for Stalin. But he was not yet ready wholly to overwhelm the moderates in the leading policy bodies. In the key organizational posts in the party and purge machinery, it was another matter. Nikolai Yezhov, a tested and ruthless operator, became a member of the secretariat, and on 23 February was appointed in addition to the key post of head of the Party Control Commission. Another prominent young Stalinist, Kaganovich's protege Nikita Khrushchev, was made first secretary of the Moscow Party Organization a few days later. Andrei Vyshinsky had been made prosecutor general by June. And by July 8, 1935, Georgi Malenkov was Yezhov's chief deputy as assistant director of the Cadres Department of the Central Committee. Thus by mid-1935, Stalin had men of his personal selection, who were to prove themselves complete devotees of the purge, in control of Leningrad and Moscow, and in the Transcaucasus, where Beria ruled, in the Control Commission and the key departments of the Party Secretariat, and in the Prosecutor Generalship. And if the leadership of the NKVD was later to prove unsatisfactory to him, it was at least totally under his control. In the formal organs of party power, the Central Committee and the Politburo, he had not yet achieved the same total grip. Many of the provincial committees were still headed by men who dragged their feet. And the Ukraine was under the control of the same style of leadership which it had been necessary to remove in Leningrad by an assassin's bullet. But a firm basis for attack on these old cadres had been established. A quiet purge of the ex-oppositionists now in jail continued. The leading ex-Trotskyite, Ivar Smilga, arrested on January 1, 1935, was secretly sentenced on March 26, 1935 to imprisonment in the Verkhny Uralsk isolator, later, apparently on January 10, 1937, to death, by the military collegium. In March and April 1935 came a secret trial of the Moscow Counter-Revolutionary Organization, Workers' Opposition Group. A. G. Slyapnikov, Lenin's chief representative in Russia during the First World War, had headed the intra-party workers' opposition, which had opposed the bureaucracy until Lenin banned such groupings in 1921. He spent his later years sometimes free, sometimes in jail, sometimes in exile in the Arctic, or working on the lower Volga shipping line. Like Smilga, he was rearrested on January 1, 1935. Slyapnikov, his chief henchman S. P. Medvedev, and 13 others were now sentenced by the special board to various terms of imprisonment, though worse faced them later. Shlyapnikov's wife was sent to labor camp. The same piecemeal progress was being made, during this outwardly quiet period, in thaw control and in the party purge. A circular of March 7, 1935 ordered the removal from libraries of all the works of Trotsky, Zinoviev, and Kamenev. Another, dated 21 June, extended the list to include Preberzhansky and others. A secret letter dated May 19, 1935 from the Central Committee called for the special investigation of enemies of the party and the working class who had remained within the party. On 27 June, a special, and evidently typical, Central Committee resolution on the Western Province censured the local officials in charge of the party purge for insufficient vigilance. In the Smolensk Rayon, 455 out of 4,100 members examined were expelled, after 700 oral and 200 written denunciations. One member was denounced for having admitted that he had in his possession a platform of the Trotskyites. A professor had given a favorable character reference to a Trotskyite and now never expressed his attitude toward the Trotskyite counter-revolution. A group of worker members of the party wrote denouncing their local leadership for refusing to listen to denunciations. Typical of remarks at party meetings were such attacks as "there is information that Smolov is married to the daughter of the merchant Kovalev," and that the party organizer of the second group of the institute is the son of a person who was given a strict reprimand. By 1 August, as a report signed by Yezhov and Malenkov noted, 23% of the party cards in this representative area had been withdrawn or held pending investigation. Even more striking were some of the changes in Soviet law. A decree of 30 March made the illegal carrying of a knife punishable by 5 years imprisonment. A decree of 9th of June, later incorporated into the Criminal Code, Article 58, IA, IB, 9, was a much more startling departure, exemplifying in full the style of the Stalin epoch. It provided the death penalty for flight abroad by both civil and military. In the case of the military, members of the family aware of the intended offense were subject to up to 10 years imprisonment, while, the real novelty, those who knew nothing whatever about it, the remaining adult members of the traitor's family, and those living with him or dependent on him at the time were made liable to a 5-year exile. A Soviet law book, justifying this, speaks approvingly of the application of special measures in respect of the adult members of the family of a serviceman traitor in the event of the latter's flight or escape across the frontier in those cases where the adult member of the family in no way contributed to the act of treachery that was being prepared or executed and did not even know of it. The political significance of it consists in the strengthening of the overall preventive action of the criminal law for the purpose of averting so heinous a felony as the action of a serviceman in crossing or flying across the frontier, as the result of which the guilty party cannot himself be subjected to punishment. In fact, we have a crude and frank institution of the hostage system, a sign of the way Stalin was thinking in other cases as well. More extraordinary still, and just as relevant to Stalin's general plans, was the decree of April 7, 1935 extending all penalties, including death, down to 12-year-old children. This decree was noted in the West, where it made very bad anti-Soviet propaganda. Many people wondered why Stalin had made such a law public. Even if he meant to shoot children, this could be done without publicity. Indeed, an NKVD veteran tells how the best prize army, homeless orphans of the wars and famines, had been reduced by indiscriminate shooting 2 or 3 years earlier. Stalin's motives, as it turned out, were centered elsewhere. He could now threaten oppositionists quite legally with the death of their children as accomplices if they did not carry out his wishes. The mere fact of his accepting the disadvantages of publicizing the law gave it a sinister seriousness. Why the age limit of 12 was chosen is uncertain. Presumably, there were oppositionists whose children were just within that limit. On the other hand, it might be suggested that Stalin had a rough precedent to which the opposition had made no objection. The youngest member of the Tsar's family, executed in the cellar at Ekaterinburg on July 16, 1918, was the Tsarevich Alexis, age 13. As to the precise timing, while it is true that Stalin often showed great foresight in his maneuvers, it seems that we must associate this decree with another case that was just coming up. Almost nothing was published on the matter. But in effect, it was an attempt to link the opposition with an alleged plot against the life of Stalin. In the library of the Central Executive Committee, by a young woman. Starting in January 1935, there were scores of arrests, eventually, according to a recent Soviet account, 110 in all. 9 cleaners, a porter, a 20-year-old telephone girl, 18 librarians, 6 persons working in the secretariat of the Presidium of a Central Executive Committee, 16 from the Kremlin Commandant's Administration, and other army men. In fact, there were 2 main terrorist groups, one in the library, the other in the Commandant's headquarters, linked by the fact that one of the librarians was the sister of the leading victim from the Komandatura, and a White Guard counter-revolutionary group of 5, all from non-Kremlin jobs, was thrown in for good measure. The rest had various personal connections with the Kremlin accused, though they also included Trotsky's son Sergei Sadov, and 5 of Kamenev's relatives, his ex-wife, Tatiana Glebova, among them. For once again, Stalin determined to involve the opposition. Kamenev had a brother, the painter Nikolai Rosenfeld, whose Armenian ex-wife, Nina, worked in the Kremlin library. The case was first referred to in Soviet articles in 1988 and 1989, which describe it as the Kremlin affair. Rosenfeld, after interrogation, implicated Kamenev. Others giving such evidence, though not charged, included Pykel, Zinoviev's secretary, the prominent Zinovievite SM Zak Skladnev, and Zinoviev himself. Yazhov, as chairman of the Control Commission, demanded the death penalty. Opposition remained strong. Gorky was particularly outspoken. Yanukidze's job as secretary of the Central Executive Committee included general supervision of the Kremlin. It was easy to accuse him of negligence in the plot formed in the Old Palace. Moreover, he had long been giving a certain amount of protection to minor non-political survivors from the pre-revolutionary classes, with, of course, Stalin's concurrence. This, too, was now tuned against him. He seems to have been removed from his posts as early as March, with the promise of an important position in the Caucasus, which never materialized. Another prominent Kremlin figure and confidant of Yanukidze also went. The Latvian Peterson, who had commanded Trotsky's train, the celebrated mobile GHQ of the Civil War, was commandant of the Kremlin. He was not arrested, but was transferred in September 1935 to a post in the Kiev military district, which he held until 1937, when he was liquidated. He was later, in 1938, to be named as one of the military conspirators who had been thinking in terms of a Kremlin coup, having allegedly been selected for the purpose by Yanukitza. Yanukitza was not the only party veteran who had experienced qualms at the fierceness of the assault on the opposition. The Society of Old Bolsheviks, and the equally distinguished Society of Former Political Prisoners, had been collecting signatures in influential circles for a petition to the Politburo against the death penalty for the opposition. This was now treated as factional activity. On 25 May, a brief decree by the Central Committee abolished the Society of Old Bolsheviks and appointed, to deal with its dissolution, a commission headed by Shkiryatov and consisting mainly of Stalin's young adherents, including Malenkov. The society had its own publishing house, which printed the memoirs of its members and certain theoretical works. It was almost impossible that these, particularly the memoirs, should not have been offensive to the new regime. In fact, Stalin was, as usual, combining a political move with the settlement of a personal grudge. Starting at the end of July, Pravda itself prominently serialized an example of what was now to be the only right sort of record of the party's past, a history of pre-revolutionary Bolshevism in the Caucasus by Beria, which is simply Stalinist hagiography. The facts had previously been distorted, with hostile intent, it was said, by Yanukitza and Ora Kalashvili. They had not given due prominence to Stalin, though in their time their works had appeared to strain facts in his favor rather than not. Standards of adulation were changing. Yanukitza's fall has been attributed entirely to Stalin's desire to inflate his own role in the history of Caucasian Bolsheviks, and the responsibility put on the notorious falsifier of party history, the provocateur and adventurist, Beria. Beria's role in the whole question of these memoirs can only have been secondary, and this sort of interpretation anyhow takes too superficial a view of Stalin's motives. But still, this concern with suppressing and transforming the past certainly played its part. In fact, old Bolshevik memoirs now ceased to be published. Kosyur, who had evidently thought of writing some, was told by Petrovsky that Stalin was opposed to this. Early in June, Yanukitza was politically outlawed. He was denounced, in one of the main items of the agenda at a Central Committee meeting held on 5-7 June, for political and personal dissoluteness. Yazhov reported on his errors, and the former secretary of the Central Executive Committee was expelled from the Central Committee and from the party. Over the following weeks, the papers printed violent attacks on him by Stalin's young party secretaries in Leningrad and Moscow, Zhdanov and Khrushchev. He was accused of taking enemies under his wing, former princes, ministers, courtiers, Trotskyites, etc., a counter-revolutionary nest and in general of rotten liberalism. These former princes and so on seem to have been represented by a quasi-aristocratic woman who tended the Kremlin antiques and who was now inflated into an agent of the class enemy. In one account, the girl alleged to have plotted against Stalin's life was a countess. In any case, the link with the case boiling up in the Kremlin is undoubted. Yanukitza was not put on trial at this time, being presumably charged with negligence only. But he seems to have been under arrest not later than early 1937.7. The next blow was at the Society of Former Political Prisoners, which was dissolved on 25 June, in the same way as the Society of Old Bolsheviks had been. A commission headed by Yazhov was appointed to deal with its effects. A number of its members who had been especially closely involved in the campaign for clemency were already, or were shortly to be, under arrest. If the old revolutionaries had been offering a certain resistance, the main revulsion from Stalin and his new line was to be found in the very youngest generation of communists. As we have seen, openly seditious remarks were noted in their ranks by the NKVD. More threatening still, the Kirov murder inspired various groups to talk of, and even to plan, in an amateurish fashion which was no match for the police of the new regime, the killing of Stalin. Either way, such circles were now invariably arrested and shot. But the Komsomol as a whole also needed thorough purging. Its reorganization, with a view to eliminating enemies of the party, was announced at the end of June. In general, Stalin's moves over the past 6 months had strengthened his position in obvious ways. Even so, they had not broken down the resistance to a death sentence on Kamenev. It was clear that that could only be done by a massive purge of the Stalinist moderates. And for this, the ground had not yet been adequately prepared. For the moment, Stalin abandoned the project. And so, on 27 July, Kamenev was sentenced, at a secret trial by the military collegium of the Kremlin case, to 10 years imprisonment under Article 58(8) of the Criminal Code, dealing with terrorist actions against Soviet officials. Two of his fellow accused, A. Isin Lobov, secretary for assignments to the Kremlin commandant, and M. K. Chernyavsky, head of a sector in the intelligence administration of the Red Army, were sentenced to death. The two Rosenfelds and six others got 10 years imprisonment, and another 19 various shorter terms. Of those so sentenced, 14, including Kamenev, pleaded not guilty, 10 pleaded guilty only to anti-Soviet talk, and 6, including the two Rosenfelds, guilty to terrorist intentions against Stalin. In addition, the NKVD Special Board sentenced 80 more to imprisonment, 42, or exile, 37, though Olga Kamenieva, party member since 1902, was only forbidden to live in Moscow or Leningrad for 5 years. Sergei Sadov was among those sent to labor camp for 5 years. All concerned have lately been rehabilitated. The heavy pressure exerted by Stalin over the summer had to some degree advanced his plans for a purge. The dissolution of the society uniting the old Bolsheviks, the campaign against the rotten liberalism of Yanukitsa, and the fresh sentence on Kamenev had taken things a step further. Nevertheless, the going had been hard, and it had been impossible to produce a public trial or even a death sentence for Kamenev. Further and more thorough preparation was evidently necessary. The next months were spent in consolidating the gains achieved and laying the groundwork for an NKVD set piece to crush the opposition. The NKVD prepares a trial. From the point of view of the purges, the period from July 1935 to August 1936 was to all outward appearances something of an idyllic interlude. In the sense that nations without any history are the happiest, it seemed a greatly improved time. There were no deaths of Politburo members, no trials of important oppositionists, no removals of leading political figures. The harvest, too, was reasonably good. A plenum of the Central Committee held in December 1935 passed a long resolution on checking party documents, which was later to be the organizational basis of the purge at the grassroots. But in itself, it appeared harmless. Moreover, it was announced at the same time that the purge of the party ordered in 1933 was now complete. The draft of a new constitution had been occupying the minds of Bukharin and Radek, as the active members of a commission set up for the purpose in February 1935. It was ready in June 1936, and Bukharin, in particular, thought of it as a document which would make it impossible for the people any longer to be pushed aside. It was indeed a model document, giving, for example, guarantees of freedom from arbitrary arrest, Article 127, the inviolability of the home and secrecy of correspondence, Article 128, and indeed freedom of speech, of the press, of meetings, and of demonstrations, Article 125. That Bukharin, who was mainly responsible for it, thought that it might be implemented shows that even he now imagined that a genuine relaxation was taking place. Bukharin's view of the communists at this time was they are all good people, ready for any sacrifice. If they are acting badly now, it is not because they are bad, but because the situation is bad. They must be persuaded that the country is not against them, but only that a change of policy is necessary. He had come around to the view that Bolshevism needed humanizing, and had looked to the intellectuals, in particular, Ivan Pavlov and Gorky, to help him. Pavlov, the great physiologist, was strongly opposed to the communists. When Bukharin's name was put up for election to the Academy of Sciences in the mid-1920s, Pavlov spoke against him as a person who was up to his knees in blood. Eventually, however, the two men had become friendly. Pavlov himself was indeed now dead. But Bukharin is even quoted as wanting the intelligentsia to put up candidates under the new constitution as a sort of second party, not to oppose the regime, but to give constructive criticism. In reality, Stalin had simply changed his tactics. Under the calm facade, there was furious activity. He had ready all the ingredients which he was to bring together into the set pieces of the Great Purge. First, he had developed direct control of the secret police and had set up other mechanisms of power responsible to himself alone and capable, given careful tactics, of overcoming the official hierarchy of party and state. Second, the tradition of fake trials for political purposes had been established and not objected to in the party, whose tradition of maintaining flat untruths for political purposes was in any case of still longer standing. Third, the former oppositionists had, under the particular pressures available in communist life, already been induced to make admissions of error which they did not sincerely believe to be correct, in what they took to be the party's interest. Fourth, his operatives were accustomed to the use of torture, blackmail, and falsification, if as yet mainly on non-party figures. If his technical arrangements were complete, The same was evidently not so of his political preparations. It was still quite possible that he might have met with formidable opposition if he had set about the problem in the same way again. He chose a different method. The case was to be prepared in secret, not too difficult a matter, as the doomed Zinovievites and Trotskyites were already under arrest. It would take its course during the summer vacation, and in the absence of Stalin in particular. The death sentences would not be mentioned until they were pronounced,